Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I'm your Eric Anthony, and for this episode, we're very, very happy that you joined us because we have a returning special guest, none other than the legend himself, Jerry Conway. We were able to have Jerry Conway as one of our first big-name interviews and guests a few years ago, and it had been a while since I had gotten a chance to speak with him, so I thought, why not reach out again and talk about some of the other things that he's worked on. I mean, very few people have been as prolific and successful in this industry as Jerry Conway has, creating a multitude of characters that we see in multimedia today, as well as some of the most influential stories that are still being referenced. If you ever have seen a Spider-Man movie, whether or not you've realized it, you've encountered and engaged with one of Jerry's classic stories. If you've ever watched a Netflix series from Marvel, and you've seen The Punisher on TV or in one of the movies, that's a creation of Jerry Conway, as well as many of the collaborators that he's worked with in his career. So I was really excited to be able to have him return back to the show and to be able to talk a little bit more Spider-Man with him, because for those of you who know me, Spider-Man is one of my favorite characters, and there are very few creators outside of, I would say, Stan Lee. There's a short list of people who have had as much of an impact on Spider-Man as Jerry Conway has. And we're just scratching the surface, really, with the things that we could talk to Mr. Conway about. Hopefully in the future, we'll be able to have him back on the show, because he's got a whole career at DC Comics where he's written Superman and Batman, and had a very, very extensive run on the Justice League. Very influential creator working for DC Comics as well. So we haven't even scratched the surface of that part of his career. So hopefully in the near future, within the next year or so, we'll be able to get him back on and we could talk about all of those stories that he was able to tell as a part of his very storied and successful career. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy the episode. Again, leave us a review at iTunes or wherever you subscribe to your podcast. Follow us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram and all your different social media avenues. And enjoy the episode, everybody. Thank you again for listening and downloading. Okay, everybody, we are happy for another wonderful conversation with... This is not a term to be used lightly when it comes to this guest. We've had him on before, but he is truly a legend in the industry of comic books. Is Mr. Jerry Conway. Thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Hi, Eric. I'm glad to be here.
So, you're a baseball fan, right?
I wouldn't say I'm a huge baseball fan, but yeah, I've followed it. You know, I'm not like my nephew-in-law who knows all the stats and follows the teams religiously.
But you grew up in New York during a wonderful era of baseball. So I wanted to ask a question that maybe you would be able to give insight and be as generous as you'd like.
Oh, sure.
Okay. So Jerry Conway is to comic books what who blank is to baseball.
Oh, God. I wouldn't even know where to put myself in that list. I mean, given my malapropism, sometimes possibly Yogi Berra.
Hey, that's a good one though. He was a legend himself, right? Hall of Famer. But
sure.
That's the humble answer.
I don't know. Maybe a Cal Ripken type. How's that? You know, someone who shows up for the games, isn't always is always trying at least. How's that?
That's a good one. So Cal, definitely a legend, the Iron Man, right? Always showed up for work, and an MVP, best at his position.
Well, at times, yeah. I mean, I would hesitate to compare myself to any serious baseball player, to be honest with you. It's flattering that you would make you would even try to get me to do that.
I thought it would be a little bit of fun to start us off. So, you know, you always get asked the same question every time, and I'm sure you're sick of it. So we're not going to talk about Gwen Stacy this episode. But what I wanted to ask you about was, you have a very interesting experience with the character of Spider-Man, who I love all of the work that you've done with him. But when you first got on that book, your age and the age of the character went hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you might be the only person to have written that book that would have had that experience with that character. What was that like for you, and how did it inform the way that you approached writing the character at the time?
Well, it was really helpful because at that period in my career, I was operating mostly from instinct and from the arrogance of ignorance, you know, that I didn't really have a fully structured understanding yet of what I was trying to accomplish. So I was mostly writing by the seat of my pants. And being of the same age and being, you know, from a similar background to a certain degree as Peter, you know, kind of a nerd in high school, growing up in Queens, you know, being a freelancer, having sick parents, you know, in my case, I had ill mother and father. It gave me, you know, some insights into Peter's mindset and background that I don't think someone without that experience set might have had. So I consider it a real advantage, you know, to compensate for some of the lack of real experience that I had coming onto a book of that stature.
Mm-hmm. And when you were writing the stories that, I mean, obviously, like you said, you're flying at the seat of your pants, and I'm not sure, but I imagine that back then you didn't have all of these six issue arc stories that were going to be collected in graphic novels, right? So as you're writing these stories, were your experiences in life informing some of the decisions that Peter would make, or vice versa? Because sometimes the art can inform what we do in life, right?
Well, sure. I would say it was more my personal experiences informing Peter's storylines. I mean, for example, Peter's efforts to find a place to live were similar to mine. The gag where he's told that his apartment has a river view, and you have to lean out and look out to the left to find it was exactly what I had gone through. You know, just little minor things like that. And then also the anxiety of, you know, living hand to mouth from job to job was something that freelancers of my generation and probably now too experience. And when I said that we flew by the seat of our pants, I mean that kind of literally. I don't think I ever plotted more than a couple of issues in advance, if then. I might have a storyline, a general idea of a storyline that I was going to pursue over, you know, several months, but nothing like what we see these days with nailed down year-long or five-year-long arcs. That was more ambition than I had at the time, especially given the nature of the work, which was, you know, very hurried, very much deadline driven, and much less flexible in terms of dealing with deadlines than many creators have today. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that, you know, that you could go months without publishing an issue in a series would have been just like mind-boggling to people like me. You know, I had to get scripts in so that the artist could start drawing them, so that the letterer and inker could ink them, and we could get them to production by a certain date, so we'd meet our printing schedule, or it would be hell to pay. So it's a totally different environment for creativity.
Did you find that it helped with creativity? Because for some, like, there's no time for a writer's block, or there's no time to question. Like, we got to figure out something.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, it definitely helped. I mean, it hindered too, mm-hmm. because, you know, sometimes I would set up a storyline where I'd put in a thread for a subplot, and then lose track of it because something else would come up, and never finish off a something that I'd left dangling. But the advantage of this kind of procedure was that you couldn't, you know, worry about what you were doing too much. I became very adept, and I guess I'd always been adept at writing fairly finished copy in a first draft. And that was a skill that I actually had to work to overcome later on, you know, when I was trying to better myself as a writer and do more rewriting and more polishing of my prose. But at that time, you know, it was a skill that was very valuable both to me and to the editors that I work with. Mm-hmm.
During that time, other than Stan, very few creators on that character have laid so much track down or added spokes to the wheel with characters that you either created, characters that, in the case of Gwen Stacy, died. What was one of the things during that time that you look back on and you're most proud of? On that particular run.
I am very proud of the Gwen Stacy story, obviously. I think for that was a lightning in a bottle situation where the outcome exceeded the capabilities that I brought to it. I don't really know quite how I was able to accomplish what I accomplished with that. But beyond that story, I was very happy with the work that I did with Ross Andrew in general. Mm-hmm. The two of us were a pretty tight collaborative team, and some of the work that we did, even, you know, the kind of minor rebooting of characters like Molten Man, for example, I found a lot of fun to do. The Jackal storyline, I think, the return of Gwen Stacy as Gwen's, you know, clone, all of that worked pretty well, mm-hmm. Given the constraints that we were under and the requirement, you know, to bring her back in the first place, which wasn't my, you know, my intention. But I think we did a fairly good job doing it. You know, generally speaking, I'm just proud of that I wrote that book for 3.5 years that I did during that era, mm-hmm. and managed to, you know, tell stories that were stories that I wanted to read and that have had some resonance, you know, decades later.
Yeah, I often tell people, because, you know, comic book fans, they always say, what's that book that you, if you could splurge at a con, what would it be? And I always mention the Gwen Stacy, because not because the cover in itself is that it's got some special sort of cover, but the value of that comic is really based on the story and what it meant to the character. Whereas later on, the comics that become collectibles are these variants or these, you know, forced rarity. Whereas mm-hmm. back then, yeah. those stories were, this happened in the story and it's important to the history of this character. So, I mean, kudos to you. I know you didn't plan on it being as big as it turned out to be, but, you know, well done. Did you ever think that your clone saga would get as much mileage as it ended up getting?
No, not really. I mean, again, one set of perspective to remember about these books is that at the time that I was writing Spider-Man, the character was about 10 years old.
Right.
So there wasn't a lot of history to the character. And the idea that comics would be around in, even in 5 or 10 years struck all of us at the time as kind of iffy. You know, we were aware that the sales of in the business as a whole were way down from where they had been at their peak in the mid-60s, or even in the 40s, obviously, which is the best-selling era of comics. So we were looking at this as a kind of a transitory field, and the idea that any of it would have any repercussions 5, 10, 15 years later, or even 20, 30, 40 years later, yeah. would have struck us as ludicrous. you know, we were just happy to be able to do the stories that we wanted to do and participate. You know, it was like, if a lot of us were, you know, we were young guys and young women, groupies being allowed to play with the band. Right. I mean, that's kind of how it felt.
Right. You know, yeah.
It was a surreal experience for most of us, I think. that we were allowed in, because my generation was probably the first generation of creators who seriously wanted to do comic books as an art form. You know, right. that we came to it with the ambition to do comic book stories.
Right.
Most of the people that we were working with who were our seniors were people who had had different ambitions. In some cases, I mean, in other cases, they definitely wanted to do good work in the comic book field too. But their primary goal had been to be commercial artists or to be newspaper strip artists. Very few writers wanted to be writers in comics.
Yeah,
they did it for the money. So the idea that people like Len Wein and Steve Englehart and Roy Thomas and Marv Wolfman and myself, you know, that we sought this out as mm-hmm. as potential careers, struck them as bewildering.
yeah.
So for us, it was a real great opportunity to do it, and that was the only motivator that we had. I don't know that any of us thought that there would be a future to it.
Right. What was that like being in the Marvel offices, having been fans of these guys? Like, the same way for us when we get to talk to the creators such as yourself, that's just as meaningful for us to be able to meet a movie star, because you guys are the ones who actually create the stories, right, that were meaningful to us, create those portals that we enter. But for guys like such as yourself, and you mentioned Marv Wolfman and Len Wein, what was it like being in the room with Jack Kirby or seeing his work come in? Because I know he worked a lot from home, right?
It was like getting to hang out with Lennon and McCartney.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, how do you even wrap your head around it if you're a kid? There's actually a movie that's based on a book that I point to as saying, that was my life. And it's Almost Famous.
Okay.
The movie that Cameron Crowe, about the... I mean, basically, the reality of the story was that this high school writer, Cameron Crowe, in real life, pretended to be a much older guy and managed to somehow follow a band and be with the band on their tour as if he was writing for Rolling Stone. He told them he was writing for Rolling Stone, and they let him hang out. And he hung out with the groupies, and he hung out with the band, and he got to know all of these people, and it was obviously very, very exciting for him, and at the same time, very surreal.
Mm-hmm.
So that was how it was for me. I was 16 years old, hanging out with people who were, you know, 20, 30 years older than me,
mm-hmm.
Who I had literally grown up worshiping, you know, and the same is true for Marvin Len and Roy to a lesser degree because he was a little older when he got in. But we were all kind of fulfilling, you know, this fanboy, groupie, roadie kind of fantasy. Seriously, watch Almost Famous, and it is pretty much
what you were
emotionally
feeling.
What it was like.
Right. Yeah, that's awesome. I can't, like, I've heard stories, I think, from Len Wein and Marv Wolfman saying that when they were young, they would actually go to Jack's house and Roz mm-hmm. would make him a sandwich and they'd watch him actually create some of those classic stories. So I can't imagine what it was like for all of you guys to be witnessing history, but then at the same time, making it with a lot of these characters that they had brought into the world. They passed it on to you. Did you feel like a certain fear or sense of responsibility to the character, or did you have like, let me have them, let me add it, let me touch these these stories?
It was an enormous sense of responsibility, and you don't want to screw this up. I really wanted to channel Stan Lee, you know, in my writing, as I but also at the same time, you know, express my own view of the character and my own sense of the characters. In my view, what I was trying to do was do the stories, the next iteration of stories that Stan would have done if he had been me.
Mm.
You know, in other words, taking to the next logical step, the groundwork you know, that he had established, and building on that and creating from that. You know, if you're doing a comic book that is supposedly about real characters with superpowers, what kind of emotional journey would they go on? That was what I was trying to express. Right. But to do it in a way that Stan, you know, that emulated his voice without being exactly his voice.
Right. You wanted to make it somewhat of a seamless transition, but to mm-hmm. get your chance at it. So you mentioned your work with Ross Andrew. You guys, if I'm correct, both collaborated on the Superman and Spider-Man crossover, right?
Yes. Yeah, yes.
Were you working on Spider-Man at the time, or were you at DC then?
And I had Superman? Just left. I think I had left Marvel maybe a month or two before the deal was finalized between Marvel and DC. So I was positioned at DC as a new star that Carmen Infantino felt that he had stolen from Marvel. Mm. You know, just like he had stolen Jack Kirby, now he had stolen Jerry Conway. I mean, whatever that was worth, you know. But since I had been the writer on Spider-Man, I was the logical choice to be assigned the project by Carmine, also to kind of stick the finger, you know, his finger in Marvel's eye. and I had asked for Ross to be the artist because he was one of the few people who had actually drawn both Superman and Spider-Man. Okay. And was extremely qualified to do that. And also, I have to admit, you know, selfishly, I really, really enjoyed working with Ross and knew that we would be a good collaborative team.
So the concept of that story, was that something that they allowed you to be able to come up with, or was there some sort of editorial mandate from both companies to be like, make sure you don't do this to our guy?
No, the funny thing was, I mean, I was in effect the editor for DC because I was a writer-editor at DC, and Carmine, while he was officially, you know, supervising it, he had no real interest in supervising it. And at Marvel, the Marvel editors at the time, I think Len was the editor in chief at Marvel at that point, and he literally didn't want to have anything to do with it. Just felt like, you know, this was a hot potato that he didn't want to hold on to. So Roy Thomas was ostensibly the consulting editor representing Marvel. And Roy's attitude on it was, you know, you guys got this, you know, take it where you want to go. Mm-hmm. And so it was basically Roy being a sounding board to a degree, but mostly just saying, you know, that sounds good to me. And Ross and I working the story out in intimate collaboration between us. We had a general idea of what we wanted to accomplish, and then knowing that I wanted to be fair to both DC and Marvel, and to give them equal time, we planned this book out page by page to balance the two characters with a similar number of double page splashes, a similar number of action scenes, a similar number of scenes with their secondary characters, and so on, and fit that into a overall story that was pretty much designed to allow as much fun as possible for the meetup.
Yeah, I hope they. I mean, I don't know what the business behind it would be to reprint something like that, because it's hard to find. I was able to get a copy of it myself at a con, but it'd be nice to get a nice a high definition, if you will, of that again. Yeah. But I don't know if there's any sort of stickiness between the copyrights and whatnot.
Yeah, I don't honestly think it's likely to happen again. I know that they reprinted the crossovers a few, maybe a decade or two ago, they did a reprint of them in a small size format. But the two companies are at such, they're so separate from each other right now. I can't see them, you know, wanting to embrace that. I mean, it would be to the advantage of both, but
right.
You know, they're very brand oriented and, wanting to keep their brand separate.
Yeah, for sure. So one thing I always wanted to ask you last time we spoke was about your second era on Spider-Man, when you got to work with Sal Buscema on Spectacular, and also you were doing web. What was it like returning to the character after, you know, a decade or so? And a lot of the things you set in motion with your initial run had now come full circle, because when you eliminate Gwen Stacy, it opened the door for him to have the relationship with MJ. And now you inherit the character and they're married.
Yeah.
So what was that like returning to the character married?
It was a lot of fun to come back to the book with years of perspective, you know, between me and the work that I had done. And also to come back to it, you know, in my, I think at that point I was in my mid-30s. Mm. So weirdly, Peter had kind of grown up himself during that period. And I'm not really sure what the established general age for the character was at that time. But my impression was that he was probably in his mid to late 20s. Mm-hmm. So there was still some resonance between me and the character in terms of, you know, our where we were in our lives. And I was able to draw on that to a degree, but it was also a lot of fun to come in and write what amounted to twice as much Spider-Man material per month as I had been doing back in the early 70s.
Yeah.
And with a skill set that I think was much better advanced at that point. I think my writing was more mature and smarter in a lot of ways. And while I didn't have the opportunity to work with Ross again, I did get to work with two really fantastic storytellers. You know, very highly underrated pair of artists, Sal Buscema and Alex Saviak. And between the two of them, you know, we got to do some really fun extended stories, which I'm pretty proud of.
Yeah, the one bone I have to pick with Marvel, and they reprint everything, which is great for the fans, but for some reason, it's very hard to get collected forms of the Spectacular Spider-Man run. Both yours and what came after you in J.M. DeMatteis is some of the best Spider-Man stories during that time. I mean, Amazing Spider-Man gets all of the attention because of the art-driven era that was coming through, but the stories that were taking place in Spectacular Spider-Man, like when you start off with, I got the Tombstone trade that they published recently, and those first couple stories with the Tarantula. I mean, the Tarantula is a silly character, of course, because it's a comic book, but the storyline, it's still pretty timely today. I'm like, I was reading it, and I'm thinking, he's writing this in the 80s. It feels like this is a story that could be told now. What was there anything that inspired that, or was that on your mind, or was it just good for the character of Tarantula to tell that story?
Well, it was also, I mean, the 80s, I mean, it was topical because the 80s we had, you know, Reagan and the Contras and trouble in Central and South America that had political ramifications in the 80s. So that was definitely, you know, on my mind and part of a story to draw on. So yeah, I mean, in that sense, it was contemporary, but it's also an ongoing contemporary set of issues that we all, you know, America constantly is recycling through. So it's always funny to me when you know, on Twitter, you know, you have your Comicsgate type jerks, you know, saying, oh, you know, comics are too political today. We're like, where have you been? You know,
yeah.
It's always been political. I mean, you think Nomad was not political.
Right.
Captain America Nomad was not political. You think, you know, the stories that we did in both DC and Marvel, you know, in the early 70s and late 60s were not political. I mean, it's always been political. You can't escape it because pop culture is a reflection of what's going on in the mainstream culture.
And look at the X-Men, for God's sakes. Like, that's how much more political can you get?
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, I agree with you. I wish they would find ways to bring these books out. I mean, they have done a few essentials. You know, I mean, they did the Cosmic Spider-Man,
yep.
Which included some of that material. The Tombstone book, obviously. Some of Mateus's stuff has come back in essentials. I think it's all a matter of, you know, grinding through these decades and decades worth of material that Marvel has.
Yeah. What was the difference between, Amazing at the time was obviously the popcorn book, it felt like.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any sort of editorial mandate on Spectacular or Web for you that you either found challenging or that you enjoyed not having to do that Amazing may have had to accommodate?
Well, with three monthly titles featuring the same character, you have to make a decision about how you're going to, which stories you're going to tell where. And even though Jim Salicrup, my editor, didn't explicitly say, you know, I want you to stay away from this or that, I realized that for me to be able to tell compelling stories that would not be undercut or in fact undercut stories in the main book, Amazing, I would have to focus on characters who weren't part of the main subcast. So that's why I focused on people like Joe Robertson and brought in Christy Watson, Mary Jane's cousin, and developed these storylines featuring characters who were not part of the mainstream. It gave me the room to still do emotional character-based subplots, and even an extended main plot such as the Joe Robertson story without treading on the toes of the main title. And that was something I kind of decided that I would do. And I also told Jim but I asked him, if we could do this, to try to treat Web and Spectacular as biweekly, where story points would start in one book and then pick up in the second book, which would allow them to sort of have their own universe that they were operating in. That was something that I had initially done when I was doing Batman and Detective over at DC, where I tried to integrate the two titles, make them in effect a biweekly series. And that I carried over when I was working on Spectacular and Web.
Yeah, and as I was reading that Tombstone trade, I got to that point where the Inferno crossover begins, and when you were in the 70s, I don't think there were as many, or if there were any crossovers that you needed to tie into.
Yeah.
So as I'm reading this, I'm thinking to myself, man, I don't know if that was helpful to know where you need to take the character because of where the universe is going, because then not even, I would say, a year later, you had the Acts of Vengeance that you had to work with, and both of your books were affected by that. Was that helpful, or was it somewhat irritating to be like, now I got to deal with this event to dictate my story?
Crossovers and events are never helpful.
Yeah.
I don't know a single writer other than the writer of the crossover, main crossover book, who finds crossovers helpful.
Yeah.
I mean, they disrupt the flow of whatever story you're trying to tell. They complicate your job, and they never come off, as effective. They're a publisher mandated sales tool, and they didn't exist before Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Huh. So that was the first.
There just was no such thing as a company wide crossover. before that book, and to a lesser degree, Secret Wars.
Right.
I mean, with Secret Wars, it was 1 month, you know, that supposedly the entire Secret Wars took place in.
Right.
But, you know, with these other events that come along, they completely kill your the flow of your storytelling. I know a friend of mine who I won't say who it was, but he was starting a new book for one of the majors and was just getting it started. Like, you know, we're talking like issue number 3 or 4, and suddenly he had to incorporate a 3 month event that completely derailed, you know, his ability to develop the character. And the book, you know, limped on for another few months after that, and then they canceled it because they never had gave the title enough time to develop its footing and its voice. It's the worst thing that's ever happened to comics. Events are so useless and so, I mean, they're useful from a sales point of view, and that's it. And they're like a sugar high that bumps your sales for whatever period of time that they're in, and completely derail the flow and the storytelling for the title, you know, that you're working on. I they're just the worst.
Yeah, and
I've even blocked from my mind that I was involved with both Inferno and Acts of Vengeance.
Well, I mean,
when I got the collections of them, I was like, did I do something here?
Yeah, you did. You had to do quite a few, actually. I was surprised. I'm like, yeah, wow, there's 4 issues of this spectacular run that he had to dedicate to. 3 or 4 it was. I'm not sure, but you did pretty good at doing the crossover for the Acts of Vengeance with the Cosmic Spider-Man, like to make that whole situation work, to make it, you know, a Spider-Man event in itself, in a way.
Yeah. But it's still such a kludge, you know, when you come down to it. I don't know. I mean, none of that is our stories that I would have wanted to tell, but that, I mean, it's always good to on some level to be forced out of your comfort zone. So,
right.
To the degree that, you know, being forced out of my comfort zone made me have to resolve things, you know, and reach for solutions and tell stories that I might not otherwise have told, that's probably a good thing. But it's not good in the sense of if you're trying to get a rhythm going,
right,
in a particular storyline that you're developing.
Yeah. Well, speaking of major crossovers, Marvel just had one in regards to Absolute Carnage, which wasn't something that I was going to check out myself, but it's gotten some good reviews. But you actually worked on Carnage not too long ago, had a nice a nice run on the book that was very well received. That was a character that you never really got to work on during your Spider-Man times, right? So what was it like getting to play with Eddie Brock and Cletus Kasady?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I mean, what was great about that book was that, again, it sort of existed in its own universe. I mean, when I do things these days in comics, I try to work on projects that allow me to avoid, you know, the main continuity. So working on, you know, a book like Carnage allowed me to sort of like exist in a little pocket universe
for
a while. And I had a wonderful, you know, collaborator in Mike Perkins.
Yeah, beautiful art.
Who
beautiful.
Really, you know, lifted the material, you know, to another level. And getting to work with these characters, you know, that I wasn't familiar with, you know, again, stretched me into doing things that I might not have done, you know, on my own.
What did you think of that character when in its initial creation? Because I know a lot of writers were like, we were sick of having to work with the symbiotes. But was it fun for you to be able to do a horror comic? Because you have quite a bit of history in a horror comic, like creating a lot of horror characters for Marvel.
Yeah. Well, I think Hara is a terrific venue for comic book storytelling. I mean, you can get into mood and create these little set pieces that are kind of eerie and weird. And the design of this, the pitch for it that Nick Lowe, my editor, gave to me was, let's do Tomb of Dracula, which was, do something where the original concept for Tomb of Dracula was that Dracula was going to be the bad guy, and you would be focusing your attention on the people in pursuit of him. Right. And I found that to be an attractive mode of storytelling, that you can, I always like to work with characters rather than superheroes per se. I mean, right. I like writing superheroes, but the characters around the superheroes are always to me a little more interesting because they're the ones having to deal with the insanity, that they're confronted with of these superpowered beings and the effect they have on the world. So in a horror comic, pursuing the bad guy who has his own agenda does give you the opportunity to really dig down into the characters who are affected by that. Mm-hmm. And that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it was really cool too to be able to travel with the cast and crew in the book because you go mm-hmm. from one part of the United States and you end up at another part of the world, another continent completely. And all of the different set pieces that Mike Perkins was able to draw and the places you end up were absolutely beautiful. I really enjoyed engaging with it.
Really proud of that.
Yeah. Did you like having, was it designed to be 16 issues or was it, do you like having that sort of finite start and ending point or would you have wanted to continue writing Carnage?
The book was canceled because it wasn't selling as well as they'd wanted it to. So being 16 issues was something that we knew around issue 13 that okay. we were going to have like three more issues to tie it up. And I had actually thought we could probably have done 20 issues with the character. The initial plot was for 5 issues. And then as we started work on it, I was going to conclude it conclude the initial story arc with that 5th issue. Nick was like, no, let's not have him get captured yet. Let's keep it going, and see where we can go from there. And that really opened the book up, and we were able to, as you say, go to a different continent and go to another location, tell another kind of story. And we could have kept doing that. I think we could have cycled through a number of different environments and pursued the story for, to a variety of different supernatural ends.
Yeah.
But you're at the mercy of readership, so they may have liked the book, but they didn't like it enough to keep it on.
Yeah.
Keep it going.
Like they say, the bottom line's the bottom line sometimes, right? But these things now take on a life of their own in a way because once a movie's released, they'll go back to the library and re-release these things and. Mm-hmm. The story exists and you never know when it'll come back around to being that one that everyone needs to read. And there isn't, I don't think, much great material on Carnage aside from the stuff that you and Mike actually put together for a full-on story. It's a really nicely developed storyline that you can just have a beginning and end.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, obviously I'm very proud of it. So, hopefully when Venom 2 comes out, they'll... Yeah. Issue a nice hardcover of it, or bring it out as a collected edition. That would be nice to see.
Yeah, it would be perfect for it. So before we leave, I have some just rapid fire questions for you that I want to ask.
Sure.
So you have a lot of characters that you've created that are getting time in the movies, on television shows, whether they're CW or Netflix. Do you have a particular character that you are most attached to, that you care what they're doing with?
Well, I care about them all, obviously.
Of course.
I think they've been very successful with several of the interpretations. I think the Netflix Punisher was extremely well done. I mean, John Barenthal is probably the best embodiment of that character from my viewpoint that we've seen. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed seeing a lot of the work that they did with characters on Legends of Tomorrow and mm-hmm. and Flash.
Yeah,
I thought their interpretation of Vixen was just great. You know, I really enjoyed that. And you know, I'm always excited to see what's coming up next. You know, I would love to see a well done live action Firestorm series. That would be terrific from my viewpoint. I'd like to see somebody, you know, I'd like to see an appearance of Power Girl on Supergirl. I would really enjoy that, but I don't know that they can actually do that now that they've, you know, collapsed their multiverse. So although they could probably come up with as crazy an explanation as they managed to in DC after Crisis on Infinite Earths. So we'll see. You know.
Do you have a favorite extended media, like a movie or a television show that's like your personal favorite of the bunch?
Yeah, I think Punisher. You know, the Netflix Punisher was probably as well done a series as I've seen featuring my characters. And then secondarily, Legends. Mm-hmm. Legends was a lot of fun. So the year or two that they were featuring a lot of my characters. Mm.
Okay, so you've got a lot of characters, but there's very few writers who are as prolific as you. Do you have a personal favorite story that, you know, is the closest to your heart? It might not even be a popular one. It doesn't have to be Gwen Stacy.
No, I know. Actually, one of the storylines that I was very happy with when I was doing it and still look back on as a nice storyline. I mean, I'll say two. One is a non-superhero story. Okay. The Scalp Hunter, which I did at DC for about a year and a half, was a kind of an exercise for me and my interest in history. I did this month by month excursion with Scalp Hunter moving through the Civil War, and tried to follow every month events that occurred, you know, in the Civil War in that month. So, you know, as he moved through the series, he was moving through the history of the Civil War. And I was pretty proud of that. I think the other thing that I would be proud of was the work that I did with Jose Garcia Lopez on Atari Force and Cinder and Ash. I mean, anything that I did with Jose at DC, you know, certainly ranks high for me. So those are the high points, you know, other than the Spider-Man work.
Okay. So once and for all, we got to settle this. The clone controversy. Is Peter Parker the real Spider-Man or is Ben Reilly the real Spider-Man? Since you're the writer of the real clone saga.
Well, I kind of had fun with it when I left the book. My last issue was 149. And I left it kind of up in the air.
Okay.
I mean, in my heart, you know, I know it's Peter Parker, but I didn't underline it. Mm. And Archie Goodwin in a follow-up story tried to solve that, you know, and make sure that everybody believed that it was Peter. Who is the real Spider-Man. And then, of course, they open that can of worms, you know, a decade or so later. And that's fine. You know, I think it's fun to have stories like that sitting out there where readers can argue over it mm-hmm. and come up with their own interpretations. But for me, you know, it was always going to be Peter. But, you know, I like to tease people, so...
Okay, so is there anything that you're going to be working on or that we can expect to be on the lookout for?
Yeah, I'm actually supposed to be working on a miniseries, Spider-Man miniseries.
Oh, okay.
That, you know, will come out when I'm finished with it.
Okay.
Because I'm a very slow writer and, you know, not that reliable these days. So we'll see how long that takes and where it goes.
Is there an artist that you're slated to work with? Can you not give yet. Us that? No? Okay. All right. So we got to stay on the lookout for that Spider-Man. Perfect. That's great. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate talking to you.
Take care, Eric.
Okay. Hopefully we could do this again and we'll talk about some of your work with Jose Garcia Lopez, some of your Superman stuff. Sound good?
That would be terrific.
All right. You have yourself a good night. Thank you so much.
You bet. Take care.
Bye-bye.